Listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber.
And I'm Liz Holtz. Tonight on Right On Radio, Dave will talk with Tom Weber, the author of Minneapolis, an Urban Biography. Tom is an award-winning writer, journalist, and radio host, including a longtime stint on Minnesota Public Radio, where he hosted a public policy-related program. He is also the author of 100 Things to Do in the Twin Cities Before You Die.
And I'm Annie Harview. In the second part of our show, we, the hosts, will be talking about our experiences working with KFAI and asking for your support to keep the station going. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Dave, are you there?
Yes, Josh.
You are on the air.
Thank you, Josh. Thanks, everyone. Mm-hmm. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Great. Welcome to Right On Radio on KFAI. We're thrilled to have you here tonight. It is Pledge Week. Very exciting. That's got to get your blood going a little bit, I would imagine.
Old memories come back, right?
Exactly. So let's get started. We're really eager to talk with you about your book, Minneapolis, an Urban Biography. You can give us a little reading here to get started.
I'll read from the very start of the book, actually. It starts off like this. The euphoria was still there on Friday, October 30th, 1987. 5 days earlier, the Minnesota Twins had won baseball's World Series. A massive parade, the biggest since a ticker tape parade for President Harry Truman in 1948, drew 200,000 in Minneapolis, then another 200,000 when it moved to St. Paul. Many fans and players waved their Homer hankies, which had debuted during the playoffs and were already becoming iconic memorabilia. After the dynastic Minneapolis Lakers basketball team defected to Los Angeles in 1960, the arrival in 1961 of both baseball's Twins and football's Vikings kept valid and even boosted the region's claim as a big league market for professional sports. Hockey's North Stars arrived in 1967. But unlike the Lakers of yore, none of these teams had won a championship until now. But on that Friday morning, a very small group of people in the state were turning their focus away from the Twins. They were thinking about a vigil that would happen that evening and a ceremony the next morning, 125 years in the making. In the winter of 1862-63, about 1,600 Dakota women, children, and elders were held at a concentration camp near Fort Snelling to await expulsion after the six-week U.S.-Dakota War. Hundreds of them died there, mostly from measles and other diseases. The camp stood steps from the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, which is a sacred place of creation for many of the Dakota, who call it Bedote. These Dakota were imprisoned within sight of what they considered the center of the earth and of all things, their most revered spot on the planet. One of Chris Cavender's ancestors, Haza Wynn, or Blueberry Woman, had been a prisoner. He spoke at the events held on the same floodplain where the camp once stood, a wooded area next to a parking lot in what was now a state park. As elders spoke, the fort loomed atop the nearby ridge and planes passed overhead, heading to and from the nearby international airport. The names of those held at the camp were read aloud. Drummers closed with honor songs. The event was not universally heralded among Dakota people. Unless there are reparations, what's the point? Asked one descendant of the leader, Little Crow, who did not attend. But for those who did, it was important the state was acknowledging that this had happened. Tangible evidence, Cavender said at the time, that the Dakota were people, that they were human beings with feelings and dignity. During the same week, in October 1987, two locations fewer than 10 miles apart had hosted one of the area's brightest and most unifying events, while also marking one of its darkest chapters.
Thank you, Tom. That's Tom Weber reading from his new book, Minneapolis, an Urban Biography. That's a great place to start. And I would let the readers know that the book is full of a great storytelling and anecdotes like that. So let's start there at the beginning. So I happen to live in downtown Minneapolis, Tom, which means I'm near St. Anthony Falls. And I think if most people hear those words, if they think of anything, they think birthplace of Minneapolis. But it's much more than that. And you touched on that in your reading. So give us a little bit of the history and the context for this marvelous thing we enjoy, St. Anthony Falls.
Well, the falls are the reason for Minneapolis. That is an accurate statement. There's, you know, once it's time for the white people to come in, once it's time for the Europeans to come in and start finding places to colonize, there's very little reason to put a city where Minneapolis is today if you don't have those falls. It's the only waterfall on the entire Mississippi River. Think of that. From here down to New Orleans, there's only one waterfall on the entire river. And the water gushing over the falls like that produces immense power, which, you know, people with thoughts of starting businesses in their brains knew that that water could power mills. And it started with powering timber mills and then later flour mills. But the falls were also in and of themselves very sacred places for the people who lived here, the indigenous people who lived here before there was a Minneapolis. That said, I would actually argue that the birthplace of Minneapolis could also center very easily around Bidote because it was such a sacred place. You know, the reason that white people came to colonize in this area was because of the river, and you had this great means to transport goods. Well, the same was actually quite true for the indigenous people. This was, you know, it's not a term that they would have used at the time, but this was kind of a highway of its own for indigenous people. There was trading going up and down the river among different, you know, indigenous people from different nations and the like. So this has always been a hub type area. If you think about the power just of the water. And so really St. Anthony Falls, you know, St. Anthony, if you ever walk in St. Anthony, you see signs that say the birthplace of Minnesota. And that's playing with the history a little bit as well. But yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't, I guess, would be the way to say it.
You mentioned the settlers who came in largely at the time, 19th century, I believe. Mostly what we would call Yankees, or they called Yankees at the time, Northeastern residents of the then, you know, early states and colonies and that sort of thing. Kind of jumping ahead and having answer a big thing question here at this point. What's your sense of how the type of settler we got, Euro-American settler we got here, set the stage for what Minnesota became?
Yeah, I think it was actually quite important. There was a book that came out earlier in the 2010s that really, when you talk about when Europeans arrived and started, you know, colonizing this land, they really separated themselves. And this book, and I don't have the title in front of me, but really argues that it was really 11 different nations that this country was founded as. Yes, we were all under the label of the United States of America, but there's really 11 different distinct type of people and nations that were created within what started as the 13 colonies and then became the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So we really had, because we had these settlers coming in with these Puritan, you know, Northeast values, you know, a lot of people from Massachusetts and the Northeast and things like that, from what became Massachusetts, you really had, you know, a stock of people who believed in, you know, good education, right, for example, for their children. And frankly, the idea that it's worth it pay taxes, right? To pay taxes to pay for things like libraries as they became and schools and things like that. So there really was this, it really was a different stock of people than, for example, who came and colonized Florida or along the Eastern Shore down in what became the Carolinas and things like that. And so it really does matter that, I mean, first of all, it very much matters who were the indigenous people here for those thousands of years. And it really does matter which people among the new Americans, right, with this new country or what became this new country, which of these people came and settled the area or colonized the area, really.
Yeah, that's well described. And then moving into the 20th century, of course, and you tell these stories very nicely, more Northern Europeans and maybe some Eastern Europeans who have different sort of political ideas than, you know, maybe a more conservative, waspy sort of New Englander might have. And we get all kinds of wild populist political type movements, which leads to all kinds of labor unrest and all kinds of things. And Minneapolis becomes a sort of hotbed of progressivism, populism, and any other you know, ism you can think of for that time.
It really did. And, you know, you cannot really write the labor history of the United States without mentioning Minneapolis. What ended up happening is it was really interesting because, these are points and stories that I have gleaned from many other sources. So I'm not the first person who's written, right, you know, these stories per se, but, you know, it's actually quite important to note when you think of the time since, you know, the founding as we know it today of Minneapolis, St. Paul actually existed for about a decade before Minneapolis. St. Paul was first. And in the time that St. Paul existed, but Minneapolis hadn't yet formally been created, there was a huge economic panic. Frankly, something today we would call like another Great Recession or even a depression. And this panic really wiped out St. Paul. And it was only within the first few years of its existence, but so many, like a huge chunk of their businesses just went under. You know, they even lost some of their population. People just said, well, I'm done here, I'm out. You know, and Minneapolis, for the most part, did not have a lot to lose. There were some losses over at what became the University of Minnesota and other places here in Minneapolis, but really there wasn't as much to lose because it wasn't as big of a community. And so as St. Paul had to rebuild from that, they really, the you know, as you read in some of these other books too, they really had to just act a little more togetherly, if that's a word, because we were all in this together, et cetera, et cetera. Well, St. Paul also was the head of navigation. So St. Paul was the place where all the barges and the boats came up, but really couldn't go any farther. If you go past St. Paul towards Minneapolis on the river back then, it was really not navigable. It was hard to get boats there. So everything ended at St. Paul. So St. Paul was the places where the stuff came and was traded and then sent back out. Minneapolis, because of the falls, became the place where stuff was made from whole cloth. It started its own industries. And as that happened, you had these elites from the Northeast who had come in and they were starting these timber industries and then the flower industries. They became barons. They became really important to markets outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Minnesota. They were national companies at the time, even international, and they just didn't want the unions at all. And so you had, you know, St. Paul at one point was basically a union town. Everybody who worked in St. Paul was part of a union. Well, at the same time, basically everybody in Minneapolis was not in a union because of all these efforts by the businesses to keep them out. So it's really an important chapter in all of that.
Yeah. We were speaking with Tom Weber, author of Minneapolis, an Urban Biography. If we have time, I want to ask you about that word biography, because I think it's a curious word. It's a book that it's not as long and deep and hard as you might think a history book can be. It's full of great stories and sidebars and a lot of things that I think people hadn't thought about. And I want to jump into a big one, which is race and how leaders in Minneapolis treated minorities throughout the years. I think a lot of people plugged into this issue might be thinking of current events. Of course, your book was published prior to the murder of George Floyd and the unrest that followed. But if people didn't realize it before, they now maybe have a better idea of it, that Minneapolis has been a hotbed for the KKK, for redlining, for anti-Semitism, and of course for various poor handling and treatment of Native Americans. And you describe these stories very well. I have so many questions along this line, but how did it happen that this city sort of harbored all these sentiments? Where did it begin and why did it continue for so long? And why are we still dealing with it?
Well, you know, I don't want to pretend that what happened in Minneapolis also wasn't in a vacuum, right? You know, Minnesota came along right before the start of the Civil War, right? So all of the debates about slavery were absolutely being had here when Minnesota was a territory before it was a state. But we were really late. The first time Minnesota was a state and could vote in presidential elections was 1860, when Abraham Lincoln became president. And then a year later, here's the Civil War. And, you know, that, I think there is this idea that because we were a very abolitionist state, we supported Lincoln, we were the first state to send troops to the Union cause when the Civil War started, because we were really on the right side of history in that one question of abolition, and frankly because our territorial government and then our state government did pass progressive civil rights laws that, for example, banned discrimination in public accommodations like hotels. You know, Black men could vote in Minnesota before they could nationally. We actually legalized it here before the amendment was passed to make it national. So you're thinking, wow, you know, we're great, we're awesome, and it really covered up the ability to, it made us look like we were doing the right thing, and we were. I don't want to belittle the fact that those laws were passed, but at the same time, we also just weren't living those values day to day, and that's how it starts. And really, the big thing, and I really have to give a shout out here, is there's a great project that exists called Mapping Prejudice, which if you just Google, you can find it, and it's really one of the most unique projects for anywhere in the country for metro areas. And what they're doing is they're going through all of the deeds of property in Hennepin County and seeing if they have this language in them called a covenant. And around 1910s, private real estate agents started putting this language into the property deeds when they sold a house. So David, if you bought a house, you would sign this deed that says, here's your house, et cetera, et cetera. But inside that clause would say, all right, David, when it's time for you to sell your house, you can't sell it to a Black person. Or, you know, initially Jews were involved or included, I should say. There was a law passed about religious discrimination there that took them out of there. But a lot of groups of people were kept from buying those houses. And that kind of a contract, because it was a private deal between two people, was upheld as a legal thing. So it's not at all a mistake. This is, and the thing to remember about covenants is that covenants existed before redlining really came into what it's known as, because redlining really gets its start in the New Deal in that time period. It was happening before, but it was also happening before in terms of with these tools like
covenants. Let's define redlining for our listeners. But let's define redlining.
Well, redlining actually has a very specific definition, because when the federal government in the New Deal, so you have all these foreclosures in the New Deal, right? The Depression happens. We don't want people to lose their houses. So for the first time ever, the federal government says, we're going to actually try to help people own houses, not own them, but buy them. And how we're going to do that is that we're going to set up a federal mechanism to insure the mortgages so that banks aren't all on the hook when a mortgage is, if it does go belly up. We will federally insure mortgages, but we're going to send out our evaluators and our actuaries and all of our people to go through every plot of land and, you know, basically the whole country, and map out which places houses are eligible for these loans. So what they did is when they saw that there was a high concentration of Black people already living in the community, they would put a red line on the map around that neighborhood. And that meant that banks they still technically could have, but they really just would not, because they didn't have the federal backing, they would not insure mortgages in those areas of the city, which meant that Black families that wanted to buy homes inside those neighborhoods, frankly, where they already lived in some cases, they couldn't get those mortgages, which meant that they had to, there were some other ways of quote unquote kind of owning, but really it just became renting. So from the start, when we had this big move by the government to say, let's get people into home ownership, what we found is that home ownership then was a great way for a family to build wealth. And from the start, from the word go, Black people were not allowed, frankly, to gather and accumulate that wealth. And that helps to explain the inequities. You know, it's what Reverend Sharpton said when he was here for the funeral for George Floyd. He said, we were perfectly, he used the imagery, the horrible imagery of George Floyd having his neck knelt on by the police officer. He said, that's been happening for generations. We wanted to build wealth. We wanted to own our own homes, but you all had your knees on our necks. And that's a very important part of the history. And Mapping Prejudice has done a fantastic job to help explain that history here in Minneapolis. So I relied on them a lot in this book.
And you did a nice job, Tom, also making this point about the wealth that's passed down and handed down over generations, about noting what a piece of property that an African-American family, for example, could not purchase or was forced out of, what that is worth today.
That's right.
And it's just a constant reminder of all the wealth that's been stolen, frankly. So this idea of the importance of place and how it shaped many people's experience in the city goes a little further when we talk about urban renewal. Mm-hmm. So you're going to put in the big highway, who's going to get shafted, right? You're going to put in, you're going to tear down the old stuff and put in some shiny new stuff or some ugly parking lots, you know the story. So tell us about urban renewal, the real bad things that we did, and maybe some things we got right.
Well, there's actually two parts. When you talk about the interstates, that's kind of part of urban renewal, but urban renewal had its own separate, in the same time period, this is in the 50s and 60s, urban renewal was also an effort to say, we have parts of the cities that we, the white leadership, consider blighted and not worth saving, frankly. And they were frankly referred to as ghettos in some cases in that time. And they said, we're just going to come in and clear them. And we're going to build fancy new buildings. And man, we're ready. We're going to have a new clean, great, ready to go city. So that happened actually at the same time. And in many ways, one of the ways you did urban renewal was by bringing a highway through. So I don't want to say that those two were separate. You know, if you draw the line, if you draw a line on a map from Minneapolis to St. Paul, just get a red marker out or a black marker, just draw the line. The highway that exists, I-94, wouldn't go there. That's not the route, right? Because you had all of these houses that existed. And there's actually, as you come out of Minneapolis and head towards St. Paul, there's actually a little turn that the highway takes around Prospect Park, which is a very well-to-do, pretty well-to-do neighborhood, and very much was so back in the 40s and 50s. And we all know the story of Rondo over in St. Paul, which was a predominantly Black neighborhood that was cleared out, just totally razed so that they could build the highway. Well, the other end of that highway is here in Minneapolis, where Prospect Park was saved. You know, you could have easily drawn that line between Minneapolis and St. Paul to run right through Prospect Park. Right. But guess where the mayor of Minneapolis was from at that time? Guess which neighborhood? I'll give you one guess, right? I think you have a guess. There was also a neighborhood when you come south of downtown on 35W, right. You'll notice, and it's all under construction now, but there's a jut. You come out of downtown and you jut to the right, and then 35W from about Lake Street South is just a straight shot all the way down to Richfield. Well, why do you need that kind of jutting over. It's because the neighborhood included that neighborhood included MIA Arts, Minneapolis Institute of Arts, which is a great institution. It also included a neighborhood that frankly had a little more political power at the time. And a lot of immigrant communities and Black communities didn't have the power. And so that's where you get that clearing. You also had the Gateway District, which was a huge semblance of buildings that became a pretty downtrodden place, mm-hmm. because Minneapolis also had very arcane liquor laws that only allowed liquor to be sold in certain parts of the city, like just a handful of parts. And this was one of them. And so what ended up happening was that you had these places where liquor was sold. Well, the bar owners thought, well, at this point, we might as well pay off the officers. We may as well pay off the cops and bring in a little illegal gambling. And maybe there would be some commercial sex work. And back then it was known as prostitution. You know, maybe we'll just do it. And so this became known as kind of a seedy area. So they said, let's just get rid of the Gateway District. And they did. They flattened it. And there were hundreds of buildings. It was the largest clearing of any number. It was there were so many city blocks in Minneapolis down by the Gateway that were cleared that no city did more clearing for one urban renewal project than Minneapolis. And a lot of those, what then became parking lots or just flat lots, sat empty. They did not immediately rebuild into something bigger and better or newer and better or whatever the city leaders at the time promised. So that's what happened. With all of that. So those two things were happening at the same time.
We get something right along the way in terms of urban renewal or any,
we've done a lot of, so we've done, you know, we turned our back on the river when General Mills moved out and Pillsbury hung on for a few more decades. And then there was this point where, you know, you now know that area along the river as, redeveloped housing. It is great. It's nice down there. It's great for a walk. But then again, I can't say it was all perfect because there wasn't a ton of affordable housing in that area as well. I think Fuji-ya was a great thing that happened. Yes. And the history of Fuji-ya is actually quite an interesting story. Yeah. The restaurant doesn't exist anymore down there on the river, but you had this wonderful, immigrant woman who built this restaurant that for the first time in decades finally turned our attention back to the river. We turned our back on the river for so long, and Fuji-ya comes along and has these grand windows that look out on the river. And she says, we're going to look at the river once again, because, this is a woman who was born in Japan. And she says, in our culture, the water is everything. And frankly, the water is everything here. I don't know why we turned our back on the river here either.
Right. And you know what that's becoming now? That little park is being redone. Yeah, Sean Sherman, the Native American chef, internationally famous, he's putting a restaurant in there. It's perfect. Closing the loop, if you will.
Yeah.
You hinted at something, which I didn't mention, all these dirty little secrets of Minneapolis, and that is the mob and the mafia and all sorts of bad behavior for a long time. And many people probably don't realize that, but that's a really rich history and a lot of fun. I'll put the fun in quotes.
Well, and John Dillinger steals all the attention for St. Paul, right? Everyone who has read a little bit of history of the Twin Cities says, well, St. Paul was the gangster city because John Dillinger was there. And that is true. I'm not saying that's false, but we had some organized crime here. And Hennepin Avenue had some pretty shady places along what is now the Entertainment District as well, with some of that as well.
And they infiltrated local politics too, right? I mean, it was a long time. City Hall was a pretty crooked shot, right?
I mean, Doc Ames, who became the mayor in 1900, literally has had his own book written about him, which I encourage people to go read. The night he was inaugurated, he fired half the police force, half the police officers, so that he could replace them with cronies and with saloon keepers and political allies. And because their job wasn't then public safety. I mean, hey, we're having a big debate right now about public safety and policing in Minneapolis. And if you get nothing else out of the history, it's to know that this is not the first at all chapter of this. And it goes back literally to the turn of the 20th century when the mayor at the time made the police an extension of the organized crime he was overseeing. So police would actually work with the people who were trying to bring in illegal slot machines and things like that, say, go put it there. We'll turn a blind eye. We'll take the cut. The cut goes all the way up to the mayor's office.
Amazing. And Hubert Humphrey was instrumental in cleaning things up?
Starting to. I do not want to give the impression that everything was all clean and ready to go when he left office, but he really did come into it. He had built a coalition that included businesses and communities of color, and he had a really unique political coalition that elected him that actually allowed him to try some of these things. And we actually had, you know, we had these articles, these national articles written about us in the 1900s, for example. We were the shame of Minneapolis because of all the corruption. We were the most anti-Semitic city. We were the anti-Semitism capital of the country, according to another article in the 40s. So Humphrey comes in and says, whoa, we, you know, for all the good lists we appear on now, like for the good bar scene or the good beer scene and the bike, you know, bike friendly and great park system, we were on a lot of bad lists early on in our history. We were a place that got a lot of national press for bad reasons.
Yeah. So they let us run a little long, Tom, but so that's great. That's a credit to you and your book, but we are getting close to the end here. Do you live in Minneapolis, Tom?
No, I did when I first moved here, lived in St. Paul, but now I'm right outside of Minneapolis.
Of course. So let me ask you a question on my behalf and other Minneapolis residents then. Should we be proud to be Minneapolitans?
Well, I think you should be yes. I mean, I think you should be proud to be Minneapolitans if you're still doing the work. I remember when I was in school, and I grew up in the Chicago area, and this is not a unique experience, but I feel like the way I learned stuff was that, you know, we had, for example, the civil rights movement in the 60s, and then those pieces of legislation were passed, like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So we were good. We're good to go, right? You know, I it took me a long time, you know, as a white person with the privilege of not having to experience this, you know, not experience the racism of the world growing up. It took me a long time to really get to a place of saying the work never stops. And I think, you know, the death of John Lewis here last week really showcases that. And it's really profound. So we can be proud to be Minneapolitans if we're doing work that is uncomfortable, right? You know, there is also this concept of white comfort. We only make these important moves as far as white people want to go and are comfortable. And we just have to push past that. And that's where we can feel. I think when we're feeling the most uncomfortable is when we can feel the proudest, would be how I would answer your question.
Well said. I got one more for you. Are you hopeful for us? Are we going to make some change?
Yes. I think that I don't know what the changes are going to look like. And frankly, I don't offer the 10-point plan in the book. Oh, no. I just produce the history. But, you know, I do have to believe, I'm just going to say a line that I think a lot of people consider cliche. How can you not? What option is there other than being hopeful that we'll get some of this right? You know, we passed some important legislation yesterday at the Capitol about police reform. The people who supported it will be the first to tell you that it wasn't everything and that it was a first step. Mm-hmm. And in the past, I think we've found a lot of examples where the first step was made and we celebrated it and then we didn't do the second step.
Yeah.
So let's get the second step done and then let's get the third step and then let's get the fourth.
Well said. Tom, what a pleasure to have you on our show. It's Pledge Week. We couldn't have anyone better. It's Tom Weber in his new book, Minneapolis, an Urban Biography. Go check it out. It's wonderful. Josh, I'm sending it back to you in the studio. Thanks, Tom.
And we're back and proud to be Minneapolitans.
That's right.
Yes, right.
That was a really good interview. We've had a lot of really fantastic things like that on lately. It reminded me of when we had the author on about Sue Leaf last week about the Winchell.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of historical breakdown of Minnesota and what happens here. And nobody in town really does what we do in terms of bringing those kinds of books to new listeners. And we are here especially for Minnesota authors and have been here for a very long time. And it's essential that those same authors and their friends and family and all our listeners that maybe don't even write but listen to us because they want to hear about the books that we purvey on this show, that they support us. We need that support, and we would like you to pledge. And you can pledge by going to kfai.org, where there's a whole pledge system set up. I know in the past you've been able to call in, but because of COVID, we're not able to do that anymore. But now we're doing it online. So go to kfai.org and pledge.
That's right.
It's an exciting time here at KFAI. We have a new general manager starting next week, I believe, or the week after. And he has a real background in radio and arts and literary work and activism, social activism, social justice. And so it's really an exciting time, and we'd like to have you all support him in his new position. And that would also, besides calling us and calling him and saying, hi, you can't come down here, but because of COVID, as Ian said. But it's an exciting time for KFA. When you bring in new leadership, you never know how it's going to go. But we are excited because it's going to go good. We know that. And so we'd like you to pledge become a member, not just for the station and for yourself, but also in honor of a new trip here at KFAI, a new part of the journey. It's very exciting. So go to kfai.org. There's a button that says donate now. Just hit that button, and then there's a form you fill out. It's real easy. Bing, bang, boom.
That simple.
That's right.
That
www.kfai.org.
We're unique for a station, I think, in the area itself. We're the only one where you can offer the kind of diversity we have here. I mean, I think you and I talked about this last week, Ian, about how we're not too many programs like us are out there that will have half-hour conversations with authors, or maybe an hour, or like we did today with Tom Wepper. Mm. If you want to keep that alive, you want to keep that going, you have to help donate to KFAI to keep Right on Radio going at kfai.org.
That's right. And there are other shows, morning shows, and of course PBS does one. But even Kathy Werzer is a great fan of this show, and she's been on it many times. And she used to sometimes read the calendar, So that's really the only other outlet in this town for authors and for stuff that's literary in nature. Mm-hmm. And, we supply a huge part of that. And, of course, we're all volunteers here. That's the beauty of this organization. It's always been like that. And we're very, very proud of it. And we're proud that it's in Minneapolis, but we also love St. Paul. Annie, were you going to say something about your contributions here?
Well, I don't really know what to say about my contributions here, but I can definitely say that I'm very excited to be here, particularly because this is the first I've worked in publishing, I've worked in bookselling, and this is the first role that I've had in kind of in the book sphere that is not a monetary exchange of ideas. Every book that I discuss on this show, I discuss because I came to it in some way out of my own freedom, really enjoyed the book, and had the opportunity to have an earnest and genuine conversation with the author or translator about what's behind the book. I'm not trying to sell anything to anyone. I'm not trying to promote anything that anyone else has chosen. I'm here to explore ideas and books that I think can help people pursue different conversations in the world with a new level of informedness or a new level of curiosity. And that's what makes me most excited to be here. KFAI is so generous in being able to give people on all of the shows the level of creative freedom that they do. For example, I've also been engineering on other programs such as Disability in Progress and Somali Link Radio. And the way that people can really bring their values and their interests into the booth, and less trying to promote or sell something or a pursuit like that, and more just really digging into an idea and discussing it in a community they care about, to be listened to by a community they care about, is something that I'm proud to be part of.
Well, that's very, very well put. I wish I'd said all that. Very well put indeed. I mean, I particularly like what you're just saying. The implication of what you're just saying is that we managed to get the ego out of the way and focus on the music or the book or whatever it is that we're working on. And I think that's very liberating, as Annie just said.
Mm-hmm.
I love that about this place. And I suppose there's other stations around the country that do that, but I don't know of them, and I don't really have time to listen to them because I'm always listening to this. And, you know, when you think about, if you just leave this station on all day, you get a trip around the world. And you get a look at just about everything and all the most valuable causes that those of us all on the liberal side agree with are going to be talked about every day on this radio station and frequently every week on this show.
Mm-hmm.
You just heard conversation, you know, about what we still need to do in Minneapolis, which is true. You know, we can't be too proud. It's a great city, but there's still a lot to do. And hopefully KFAI contributes to that.
And I think, like what Tom Weber is saying, I think pushing through that realm of what's comfortable for us is something KFAI, I think, is always striving for, providing content and stuff that's at the fringe of what we maybe are always feel like we're not prepared to talk about and speak about, and then we do, and we have that conversation. I like, Annie, what you said there, talking about the piece about having a community. I know me and Liz were talking about before how KFAI is unique in that it's not really about raising our profile or raising our notoriety or who we are as individual radio DJ personalities. It's about the community. It's about what we are doing here at KFAI and trying to contribute to that and make it to a broader and bigger and bolder entity in the metro area. And I think that's really something we all really want to come around and want to congregate around this piece here and have a part of it that we can give back to. I love being here for.
Mm-hmm. Some of you should talk about briefly. I guess we're already running out of time, as it's always a mantra at the end of the show, but you should all have a quick talk about the most recent interview that you did that made you zing or made you think about it on your way home after the interview.
Well, just a couple weeks ago I interviewed Mary Logue a novel called The Streel, which is a murder mystery that takes place in Deadwood, South Dakota, in the 1880s. And it was wonderful to talk to her about the kind of research she has to do for a book like that. It's hours and hours of research for every hour of writing.
Mm.
And she talked a lot about where she had gone, the libraries that she had gone to. And what is interesting to me about that is, as a kind of a history buff, some of the things she talked about were things that I could then use to go, not necessarily research a book, but if there's something I'm interested in, you know, she mentioned, I can't remember what it was, but she mentioned a library that I didn't know existed. And that's the kind of thing, you know, it spreads. It's broader than just talking about a book, and it's broader than, you know, a 10-minute interview on Oprah where she hasn't read the book. And, you know, it's broader than that. It's not just trying to push a book or sell a book. We get these people to, because it's a half-hour interview, these folks can kind of expand what they talk about. And I know I have heard so many times that the authors really appreciate that half hour time slot, because they don't get that very often. It's usually much briefer than that. And so that was one interview. And then the other view that I just really loved doing was the guy who did an interview about the Voyager satellites that got put into the air, and the record, the special record that was on the satellites. And I was able to find the record, and I pre-recorded the interview so that I was able to intersperse his talking about things with the actual music that went up on the record on the Voyager spacecraft. And I just really enjoyed doing that. It was really fun, and it was really, I feel like it brought something extra to an interview besides just, you know, talking. And we do that sometimes. I mean, whenever there's an opportunity to do something like that, I think we do try to expand what we do beyond just a dry interview. So if you are liking that, and the other thing I want to say is, you know, about COVID, I know people are having money problems. On the other hand, if you're stuck at home, you can listen to KFAI all day long, and you can discover things about KFAI that you didn't know before because you were stuck at work. So now you're at home, you can learn more about KFAI. And after you've learned more about KFAI, I hope that you will go to www.kfai.org and hit the Donate Now button. And in your favorite show area, you can always write Right on Radio. We appreciate that.
We would. And no amount is too small.
No.
The widow's mite is just fine. For my part, Marilyn Phipps, when she was on the... She's a Haitian author that wrote House of Fossils. And she came onto the show and just wowed us with her knowledge of the Caribbean and what happens in Haiti and the dreadful situation that Haiti is in, and the just incredibly colourful world of voodoo and her family and all the different things that were going on there. It's just absolutely a wonderful conversation, and that is a wonderful book.
I was trying to think, you know, I think the last interview that happened, I think, right around the holiday season was something I had with trepidation I approached, but it ended up being my favorite interview I've ever done here with a program was with Kate DiCamillo, who was a hero of mine when I was growing up. Yeah. I had read Because of Winn-Dixie, and I read Tiger Rising, I read The Tale of Despereaux. So hearing this, reading this book, this is like an icon in my life, and I had a conversation with a person from my childhood. I was able to live out of to have this conversation with the person, this creator.
That is so cool.
And so it was really fun, but I think what's even more meaningful was I had talked to her about my ideas about how I thought she might approach her work, and I was very curious. And one thing I've always known with authors is that they don't, as much as they want to be storytellers, they want to talk about their ideas, they're always very worried about how to do it because it has a special meaning for them. It means something very special to them, and they share this, they almost feel like they're losing that charm, they're that aura about it. Mm. I asked her about that because she told me in the midst of an interview that she doesn't always try to give away the details of her stories. She feels like that's something special that belongs to her characters and doesn't belong to herself. And that was interesting. I asked her, why is that? And I think that she said that's just my commitment as an author. I think I have to pay tribute to the person, the character, and the work before myself. And that's kind of my process. And that was a very insightful discussion I had with her. And I felt like I just walked away from it. I had a broader, deeper impact on my appreciation of the craft of writing.
And she's been a terrific friend of the show. She's been on the show many times. Mm-hmm. I feel really sorry for her. Minnesota Opera, we're going to stage one of her,
that's right,
her young adult books, and COVID has completely shut down that season. Wow, what a shame for Kate. Mm-hmm. If you're out there, Kate, sorry to hear that. I was looking forward to watching that show.
Yeah.
From my end, this is Annie again. I've loved every one of the interviews that I've done. I love that I can have a conversation with someone who matches a work that I or other readers have read in isolation and can illuminate the story behind it for us. Again, in a way that's more engaged in curiosity and less engaged in the monetary side. Recently, I've been on a streak of interviewing translators, and that's been really fascinating because typically throughout the course of my life, I've primarily thought of writing as purely a creative or research-based output, rather than as much of an interpretation output. And it's been really fascinating to talk to translators because I think that what they do is sometimes misunderstood and sometimes maligned as being twisting someone else's words of an original. But from talking to translators and learning about the intimacy that you begin to have with someone else's story and characters and the conversations you have with the author if they're alive, or the amount of research and intimacy that goes into dissecting the characters, no matter what. I think that it's been really exciting to be able to share that with people. And actually, someone I'm close to shared with me recently that she now understands translation as a concept a lot better, and why it needs to happen and why it's interesting. And that's really exciting to me because I think that's such a valuable opportunity to bring books from different continents here into the main conversation that we're having here in the United States, as in our main conversations. Of course, there's no main conversation in the world. There are things going on everywhere, and it's fun to bring awareness to that.
Oh, you're so right with that. I think translations are all important. We don't do enough. I think we're one of the lowest level countries in the world per capita that's reading work in translation. And you're doing a great job with bringing those in and focusing on that. That's a great idea. We should be doing more of it. And I think we're just about out of time, so...
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our guest tonight, Tom Weber, who has the best last name in the world, plus our listeners who make the show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find out more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio, plus listen to recent episodes. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.